Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, did everybody enjoy their week off? Everybody was off last Wednesday. Did you get to do anything fun? Missed me. You must want something. Well, I appreciate that. So we're back in Genesis, Genesis 19. No preparation, no falderall, just leaping right into Genesis 19. We, 2 weeks ago, talked about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I do have a goal tonight. There's somewhere I'm trying to get, but in order to get there, we have to go through one of the more uncomfortable passages that you're going to find anywhere in the book of Genesis. So first we'll deal with Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his family on the run. The angels of the Lord have taken them by the hand, taken them out of the city, and then God has poured out his wrath on the city. Let's start at chapter 19, verse, oh dear, that one. We'll start at verse 15. 19:15. When the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters, which are here, lest you be consumed in the iniquity of the city." And while he lingered or moved slowly, the angels laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and they set him outside the city. Now, when we read this 2 weeks ago, a couple of folk immediately asked, well, what about the other children he had in the city? What about the sons-in-law that were woken up? And there's no indication that anybody but these four were taken out of the city. The ones who scoffed and didn't believe Lot's declarations and warnings perished with the rest of the city. Now, I'm going to make yet another in an ongoing succession of theological statements concerning God's grace, which is four people got out of here. And very much like we saw with Noah, it said Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And I argued that it couldn't have been that Noah was such a great guy or such a righteous guy, because no sooner does he get off the boat than we see the whole episode of drunkenness and nakedness and all the stuff that grew from that. Well, here Lot, his wife, and his two daughters are taken out. And there are folk who would say, well, that was because they were the righteous. Remember, Abraham argued with God and said, would you destroy the city for 50 righteous? Well, it turns out even four God would withhold for four and takes the last four righteous. Now, why were these people called righteous? Because I'm going to tell you now that in about 10, 15 minutes, we're going to find out that these two daughters are going to get their father drunk in order that they can produce an offspring with him. These are not what we would call righteous women. These are women who are going to justify themselves by saying, well, we need an heir, and our father's not going to have an heir. Obviously, the sons just perished with the city, and so there's really only our father and the two of us. And so our family line and lineage is going to cease to be with the two of us. Our father's going to have no heir. So they even justify themselves, but they decide that they're going to work out, one more time, going to work out their plan through their flesh, and they're going to do, you know, what God should be left to do, but they're going to do it their way through their flesh. My point being, why then, since God would know that these are the kind of people he's dealing with, why then would he save them? And it's right there in verse 16, it said that the angels laid hold on his hand and upon the hand of his wife, the Lord being merciful unto him. Anytime in the Bible you find God working in a positive way toward any human being ever, it's always an act of grace and mercy. Noah found grace, these people found mercy, and I think it's interesting that in Moses writing these accounts, he's so quick to put right on the heels of these great deliverances the kind of people that got delivered. And it's never because they themselves were so good and so righteous. It's always because God was merciful. And the reason I point this out over and over and over again is because I am highly dependent on God's grace and mercy. And the natural question arises, but Jim, you're a sinner. How could you possibly expect grace and mercy from God? I mean, consider how sinful you are as a person. And I can say, yes, but look at the long, long lineage I have of people in the Bible who found exactly that kind of grace and mercy despite being sinners. So I am comforted, I don't know about you, but I am comforted every time I read about God being gracious and merciful to people who can't possibly be considered anything other than depraved sinners. Not just bad, but you're about to read some of the worst stuff in the book of Genesis. Really bad stuff that these two daughters are going to do. They're going to do it for what they consider to be just reasons, but it's going to be the kind of stuff that makes your skin crawl. And so, continuing at verse 16, while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of the two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him outside the city. It came to pass that when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, escape for your life. Don't look behind you. It's a very important thing. Don't look behind you. Don't presume to look on the judgment of God. He has given you an escape. He has taken you out of it. And they're told very specifically, don't be so curious about the judgment of God that you think you have to observe it. Just be thankful that you've been delivered from it. So don't look back on it. Neither stay anywhere in the plains, escape to the mountains, lest you should be consumed. And Lot said unto them, O, not so, my lord. Behold now, thy servant has found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast shown unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. Now I'm going to jump forward and tell you the next little piece of the story, because there's a great irony here, which is that once he gets to Zoar, the little city in the plains, once he gets there, he realizes that his life is in fact in jeopardy in Zoar, and he escapes to the mountains. He's going to end up where God told him to go anyway. Behold now, verse 20, behold, this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not just a little one, and my soul shall live? And God said unto him, see, I have accepted thee concerning this thing, also that I will not overthrow this city for which thou hast spoken. So hurry up, haste thee, escape there, for, look at this next verse, for I cannot do anything until you have gone there. Why? Because God has already made it very clear. He's already promised that he's not going to pour out his judgment as long as there are any there that are counted righteous, any that are there that are his people, any that he is determined to save. They have to be completely escaped before his judgment can be poured out. And I think we talked about that at some length a couple weeks ago, that this shows you a bit of the character of God, and it's reassuring to know that he will not pour out judgment until the last of his people are out of harm's way. I cannot do anything until you've come there. Therefore, the name of that city was called Zoar. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar. So they left during the night. Remember, the angels of the Lord came in the previous night. He said, come and stay in my house during the night, when he met them at the gate. The sun's coming up the next day, and Lot's made his way across the plain, and he's entering the small city. And that small city doesn't fall under the hand of God's judgment, strictly because Lot and his family are there. They were very fortunate, weren't they? And the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the city and that which grew upon the ground. So he took out the people, he took out the buildings, he took out the foliage, he took out the vegetation, he burned everything on the plain except for the city of Zoar. Verse 26, but his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, Moses doesn't take the time to explain that statement. Now, granted, geographically, you're talking about the area of the Salt Sea. And so there are some commentators who, in an attempt to naturalize this, say that it had something to do with the salt sea and that somehow she was consumed with the salt in the area, there would have been salt in the air, blah, blah, blah. I guess you could guess from the blah, blah, blah part that I don't buy that theory. I say that God is completely capable of doing whatever he wants with those he has made, especially considering that he made human beings out of the dust of the ground. He's perfectly capable of making someone into a pillar of salt if he wants to. This is what's interesting about that statement. Because Moses just says it and keeps going, as if he doesn't have to prove that point. But if in fact she had become a pillar of salt on the Jordan plain, she'd still be there somewhere. Well, it turns out in Moses' time, when he's writing this, during the time of the travels of the children of Israel, she, in fact, was still there. Let me read something to you. In Josephus' writings of the Antiquities, are you familiar with that? His Antiquities? The Antiquities 1:11-4, Josephus wrote that this pillar still remained in his day and that he himself had seen it. Now, Josephus is writing during the later part of the B.C. period into the early time of Christ and has written about the wars of the Jews and has written briefly about the upsurges that are going on in Jerusalem around Jesus. And he's one of the extra-biblical historic writers who actually writes about Jesus as a historic figure. And so he writes that during his own time, there remained yet this pillar of salt out there on the Jordan plain that was reputed and renowned to be Lot's wife. Which means if it happened during the time of Lot and was still around during the time of Josephus, that when Moses was writing this, it was there. Anybody who wanted to question it, he'd just go down by Zoar. Go between Zoar and wherever Sodom and Gomorrah used to be on the plains, you'll find a salt pillar. Guess what that is? So Moses didn't feel, apparently, that he had to tell us much about it, except, and oh yeah, she turned into a pillar of salt. Now, early church fathers, by the way, talked about a crystalline rock that was associated with the tradition of this event. In fact, Clement of Rome, Irenaeus, one of the early church fathers, and a fellow named Benjamin of Tudela, who was a Middle Eastern historian, also wrote of a strange formation, and they said that it was visible in their day, and later writers then stated that it had ceased to exist. So you've even got Clement of Rome and Irenaeus, well-known names, church fathers, early Christian writers who say, well, we've seen it too, it's out there on the plain. But that over time and wind and erosion and everything else, it finally just ceased to be. But you can see why Moses wouldn't feel that he had to justify it. It was provable. It was right over there. Isn't that interesting? I find that stuff fascinating. And so she became a pillar of salt, which I think is a pretty good indication that God did not want them looking back, which should tell us something, again, about the character of God. When he's pouring out his vengeance and his judgment, he's not interested in human beings looking in on it. He's not interested in anybody watching and approving his work. He's going to pour out his judgment, and if you belong to him, he has every intention not only of taking you out of it, but protecting you from it completely, where you don't even get to see it, visualize it, have it in your mind and heart. All you're going to know is the grace and the mercy and the kindness of God. And all these people are going to know is the judgment and the power and the wrath of God. Verse 27, Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, up on that mountain where he'd looked down on the cities of the plains and argued with God about what if there's 50, what if there's 45. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and behold, and he beheld it, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham. Okay, so here we go back to that first question. Lot, his wife, his two daughters. Mere moments from now, we're going to find out that his two daughters were of questionable moral character. Why were they delivered? Because God remembered Abraham. And he sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. That's why he took Lot out, because he remembered Abraham. It was Lot's connection to Abraham that was the reason God delivered him. Because Lot was good? Nope. Because his daughters were good? No. Because of their connection with Abraham. And you're going to see throughout the rest of the Old Testament and even into the deliverance of the Messiah, God saying repeatedly that he did it because of the promise he made to Abraham. This unconditional promise that God made to Abraham is going to be fulfilled in human history because it is based on the character of God who made a covenant with himself and said that he was going to do these things. And people who want to argue, well, yes, but many of these promises were made to Israel, and then they weren't good. The answer is always the same. Nobody was good that he kept his promise with. God kept these promises because he made the promise, and then he sealed it, according to the writer of Hebrews, with two emblems by which it was impossible for God to lie. He made an unconditional covenant with himself, and so he is not keeping it because particular people were good. He's keeping it because he's good. And he's going to keep his promises to his people, those people who are connected to Abraham. He remembered Abraham, and he delivered Lot because of that connection. The same way that we can read in Isaiah, and we can read in Ezekiel, and we can read in Jeremiah, and we can read in Hosea, and certainly we can read it in Romans, that God has not cast off his people whom he had a relationship with, and he does it because of the character and nature of God himself. Do you get that? Okay, so how does that help you and I? It's really good to know that God is of such a character and nature that if he has ever loved you, he has always loved you, and that it was not based on how or who you are. God, being no respecter of persons, wasn't impressed with you to start with. And so if that's the case, then he is not going to cast you off simply because you did something that in your own eyes was so bad or so heinous that you would think, how could anybody love me? Well, the answer is nobody could except God, and that he's not loving you because you're so good. He already knew you were going to do that. He knew you were going to do that when he nailed his son to the tree. He knew that was coming. He knew when he poured out his wrath on his son that you were going to do that, and you needed to be paid for and you needed to be bought. So it's really good, again, to see the consistency of the character of God in that he will not pour out wrath on those people that are his. And the reason they are his is because promises he made to himself and not on the basis of your righteousness before him. Got that? In other words, say it with me, grace, 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 grace. Yeah. You always have to get the last word. But you're a woman, so it's understandable. So it's okay. I'm outnumbered. Is that what you're getting at? I'm so sorry. Yeah, but I got Shane.
No, you're on your own.
Oh, nice one. Nice. Nice.
I would definitely say you and Tom are down.
Yeah, it's Rick, are you with us? Where are you here? Where are you here?
I missed what you were saying. I'm sorry.
Wow.
What do you mean, weak and wasabi?
I repent in dust and ashes, and I'm so sorry. Don't let the women beat me up. All right. That takes us to verse 30. Now, like I said, this is one of the more uncomfortable passages, if not the most uncomfortable passage. It was bad enough when you had Noah's boys getting him drunk and uncovering his nakedness and how that all worked out. But let me tell you that I do believe I know why it's in here. You will recall that Abraham had a promise from God that he was going to have a child. And when he got tired of waiting on God, he went and tried to work it out in his flesh. And it produced the Arab nations, who to this very day continue to be a problem for Israel. Well, here you're going to see these two girls produce the people who are going to become the Moabites and the Ammonites. Ever heard those names? Yeah, because they're all through the Old Testament as being a problem for Israel. And they are going to be mountain people. They're going to live in the wilderness of the mountains. And so in the book of Daniel, when Daniel talks about the little horn and his going in and conquering in the Middle East, he mentions specifically three areas that the Antichrist is not going to invade: Ammon and Moab and Edom. And so then when Jesus in Matthew 24 says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, which gives them the clue where to go look, he says, you that are in Jerusalem, flee into the wilderness. And they would know exactly where to go from Daniel the prophet in that reference. They would be on their way to Edom and Moab and Ammon, those very areas, which are mountainous wilderness areas. Why? Because Lot here is going to flee Zoar and go into the mountains and live in a cave, and then his daughters are going to produce offspring, and because they're afraid to go back down into the plains, they're going to produce a people who are going to grow up in the mountain wilderness who get mentioned in Daniel and are mentioned by Jesus himself. God playing like checkers with human beings, laying out all the future in advance so that there are already peoples and cities and dwellings in the wilderness, in the mountains, that he is preparing for his people when they have to flee Jerusalem. So this, again, is one of those huge examples of compatibilism that I talk about so often. These women are going to do something really questionable. And yet God is going to use it to work to save Israel alive. So that's the big picture. These two girls are so determined to have babies, and there are no other men around because they're up in the caves of the mountains, that they get their father drunk and have sex with their father. And they both end up pregnant from their father. So these are the offspring of Lot, who wanted the plains to begin with, and when they had too many sheep and Lot and Abram had to be separated, he thought he'd choose the good land for himself. Well, now he ends up in the wilderness, up in the mountains, up in the caves. And while he's up there, he's going to produce the offspring that become the Ammonites and the Moabites. Verse 30. And Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar, and he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. So now he's gone from, I want to be down on the plains. I have so many sheep and so many flocks and I have so much wealth. I'm going to go down on the plains. And then, of course, he gets to know the kings. He's so wealthy and so powerful that when there's the war of the kings, they take Lot and all his substance, all his stuff. That's how wealthy and important and powerful he is. Now he's reduced to him and his wife, his two daughters, in a cave.
The wife's gone.
Oh, that's right. What did I just say? Wife. I keep saying wife, don't I? Wife is salt now. Wife is a condiment. And so, it's he and his daughters in a cave. That's a long way down from where he once was. And his two daughters with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar. Why would he fear to dwell in Zoar?
They weren't very good in Zoar either.
Yeah, they were just as bad as the other cities on the plain. God intended to wipe them all out.
Right.
Because they were all bad. And then I can only expect that once he got to Zoar and everybody goes, you're the only ones who escaped all that devastation over there? Well, then you must be on God's side. If you leave here, do we get killed too? I can see the tension rising. So he fears and he runs. He takes off out of Zoar, and now he's dwelling in a cave, he and his two daughters. And his oldest daughter, his firstborn, said unto the younger daughter, here they start conniving together, our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. In other words, the earth is all vile and wicked. We're up here in a cave. Mom's gone. And so when we and Dad die, that's the end of Dad's heritage. So verse 32, come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lay with him that we may preserve seed of our father. That sounds almost noble, doesn't it? We'll sacrifice ourselves to preserve the family line. Justify, justify, justify. And they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and laid with her father. And he did not perceive when she lay down nor when she arose. Because he supposedly was so drunk that he got up the next day with no memory of it.
That's pretty drunk.
And it came to pass on the morrow that the firstborn said unto the younger, behold, I laid last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine this night also. And you go in and lay with him that we may preserve seed to our father. And they made their father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and laid with him. And he perceived not when she laid down nor when she arose. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child from their father. And the firstborn, the oldest daughter, bore a son, called his name Moab. And then Moses writes, with the insight of all the years that have passed, living now in the land where the Moabites are a constant problem to the Israelites, he writes that the same is the father of the Moabites unto this day. So nothing good came from this. Here they were trying to preserve seed to their father, and they produce nothing but trouble for themselves. And the younger, she also bare a son, and called his name Ben-Ami, which means the son of my people. And the same is the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. And then Moses leaves that story right there, and in chapter 20 turns his attention back to Abram. But I like the fact that Moses included, yes, they did it, but they produced the Moabites and the Ammonites, who have been a thorn in our side ever since. But like I said, God uses that very activity to produce races of people who are in those mountain regions, preparing, by the way, are you familiar with Petra? The city of Petra? That all harkens back to the days of the Moabites and the Ammonites living in the mountain regions there off the Salt Sea, east of Jerusalem. That city and those people and those civilizations and cultures wouldn't exist had it not been for this event. These women with their dad in a cave. So God entered into it to prepare a place for his people. Chapter 20, verse 1 then begins, "And Abraham journeyed from there toward the south country and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, 'She is my sister.' And Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah." Thought she was single. Now we've seen this before. This is consistent activity by Abraham. You would think that he would have learned his lesson in Egypt. But this little passage coming up here is one of the most sovereign passages you're going to find anywhere in the Bible. Tucked away here in the book of Genesis, there's going to be a conversation between this Abimelech, a heathen king, and God in a dream, and God is going to take complete and utter responsibility for the fact that he never touches Sarah, and God even is going to say, "I kept you from sinning against me." Isn't this remarkable?
She's got to be on up there too by now, you know?
She's in her 90s.
Yeah.
So she's a looker.
Yeah.
You know?
She was really pretty before, but...
Yeah. You know. Yeah. 90 and still has kings chasing after her. Yeah. "And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, 'She is my sister.' And Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, 'Behold, you are a dead man.'" Uh-oh. That's not a good way to start communication with God. "For the woman which you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now, this is really, really important here, because she's not just any man's wife. This is Abraham's wife. And she was told many years ago that she was going to produce a child of promise. And through the child that Abraham and Sarah produced, all the families of the earth were going to be blessed. She is carrying this promise from God. What happens if a heathen king impregnates this woman? Is she going to know if that's Abraham's kid or the heathen king's kid? Or how do you call this a child of promise? This becomes a child of the flesh. So it's very, very vitally important to God that there be nobody ever lay with Sarah except Abraham. Because the promise, the whole Abrahamic covenant promise, hinges on Abraham and his wife having a natural child. So God is really rising to the defense here and makes sure to get Abimelech's attention by starting right off with, "You're dead." That will get your attention. But Abimelech had not come near her. This is good. And he said, "Lord, will you slay also a righteous nation?" Where did he get the idea that the whole nation was in trouble? That all of Gerar as a group of people were in trouble? God had just wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah and all the cities of the plain. You don't think the local areas heard about that? Sure, everybody would know that that God of Abraham has a habit of wiping out whole groups of people. And so, will you slay also a righteous nation? Did he not say to me that she is my sister? And she even herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this. So he starts pleading his case, saying, well, look, I did this innocently. I didn't know. It's not my fault. And by the way, I haven't touched her yet. In pleading his case to God. Now you want to see absolute sovereignty? God responds and says, really, you haven't touched her yet? I kept you from touching her. I kept you from sinning against me. I did these things. Do you see the minutia here? The little details of life? Here he is saying, I would like to take credit for something here. I'm innocent in everything that happened here, and I did not touch her. And God says, the only reason you didn't touch her is I didn't let you touch her. Absolute, complete control. And God said unto him in a dream, verse 6, yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart. I'm God. I know these things. For I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not suffer you to touch her. Now, let's talk about that, because this is like deep and heavy. Now we're treading through deep water. Is God capable of keeping people from sinning against him? It says so right here. God just took credit for it. I kept you from sinning against me. So, could God have kept anyone he wanted from sinning against him? Sure, yes, of course. Now think about the implications of that. Could he have kept Adam and Eve from sinning against him had he so chosen and pleased? Yep. Sure, of course. Just don't put that tree in the garden. That seems obvious enough. The tree's in the garden. Don't eat from that tree. Well, just don't put the tree in the garden. Then he puts the tree in the garden and then allows Satan into the garden. Just keep Satan out of the garden. Right? Yeah, and do you think God was surprised by anything that happened there? No, absolutely not. But the sovereign will and the sovereign plan of God is playing out in human history, including the fall of man, so that when his son comes and redeems men, all glory goes to the son. But there had to be people to redeem in order for the son to be glorified in the redemption of people. And so God, in his absolute sovereign will, brought about a situation where creatures would fall and need a redeemer, so that he could send his son to be a redeemer. After all, he is called the lamb slain before the foundation of the world. So he was already in place. Paul said that when human history wraps up, that everything in heaven and earth is going to redound to the glory of God and to Christ Jesus. And the only way that can be is if there were human beings, people, creatures, who were utterly, totally, completely incapable of getting to God and having Christ bring them anyway. And so he arranged it exactly that way. Now, the other thing you've got to know here is that when we talk about total depravity, one of the basic tenets of Calvinistic soteriology and theology, and other words that end in ology. When we talk about that stuff, we say total depravity, and then we're always quick to point out, we are not saying that men are as bad as they could be, that men are not quite as hog wild as they are capable of. And in fact, the Bible says that there's this sinfulness in mankind, but the remnant of sin God restrains. God is very careful to restrain just how bad it gets for the sake of his people that are here. In fact, when you talk about the end days and the times of trouble and everything, God even says that for the sake of his elect, those days will be shortened. You know, all these good things that happen on the earth happen because God is being merciful to his people. But there's going to be a time on planet earth where his people are taken away. And there's going to be a time when the Holy Spirit is removed and the church is gone, and then he's going to pour out judgment. And what do human beings do? Did they get really good at that point? No, they go into unrestrained madness. a kind of wildness that can only happen when that sweet influence of the Spirit of God on the earth is taken away. When the church is gone and the Spirit is lifted and God takes his hand away, men will finally become every evil thing they were ever conceived to be. But right now, God is restraining it. The only reason that you have not yet gone completely, utterly hog wild in your depravity is that God has restrained you by his mercy. He has kept you by his grace. He has kept you from sinning. He's kept you from the unforgivable sin. People worry about that, write to me sometimes and say, I'm afraid that I have committed the unpardonable sin. And I always reassure them and say, if you're worried about the unpardonable sin, you haven't committed it. If you can commit the unpardonable sin, which is blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, if you could do that, you would not care that you had. You'd be happy in your rebellion against God. But no one who has the Spirit of God inside him can actually blaspheme the Spirit of God, because the Spirit of God restrains you from your sinfulness. In other words, the good news is, despite how bad you are, you're not as bad as you could be. Imagine! No, don't imagine. Your brain would go to very dark places. But it is good to know that God, who has determined your eternal salvation, is also restraining you from ever rebelling against him. That good news? I mean, if he could restrain a heathen king and then take credit for it and say, you didn't sin against me because I kept you from sinning against me, and I know you didn't touch her because I didn't let you touch her, then that means there are a whole lot of things in this life you could have done, probably things you thought about doing, things that to this day sort of creep up in your brain and you go, oh, I'm glad I didn't do that. That was God's grace. That was God's mercy. That was God making sure that he continued to preserve his people. One more time, grace, 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 grace.
Grace.
The last word. God said to him in a dream, yea, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not suffer you to touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet. And he, notice this, and he shall pray for you. Why is that necessary? I mean, the guy's saying, I did this in the integrity of my heart. I'm innocent. Abimelech is pleading his cause, and God says, yeah, I know you did it in the integrity of your heart, and I kept you from sinning, and nevertheless, you're guilty. God holds him accountable and says, I'm going to have Abraham pray for you. Well, the other thing this does is that it raises Abraham up in Abimelech's eyes, where Abraham is now going to receive a great deal of blessing from Abimelech because he knows that God is completely on Abraham's side. Now, therefore, restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for you, and you shall live. And if you do not restore her, know thou that you shall surely die, you and all that are yours. How quickly you think he went and got that woman? Therefore, Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their ears, and the men were sorely afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said unto him, what hast thou done unto us? What have you done to us? And what have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done deeds unto me that ought not to have been done. And you know what? He's right. So does this make Abraham a good, righteous guy? No, he's walking around lying to protect his own skin and saying his wife is his sister. Worse yet, now he's going to justify himself and say, well, no, but legally she is my sister, to try to claim that he didn't really completely lie, because human beings love to justify their sin. Verse 10. And Abimelech said unto Abraham, what did you see that you have done this thing? In other words, what did you perceive us to be? You came here into our town, and what did you see in us that you thought this was an appropriate way to act? And Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. This man is walking around with a promise from God, that he is going to produce an heir, and he's going to inherit all this land. Through him, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. And yet, he blames Abimelech and the people of Gerar and says, well, I saw there was no fear of God here, and I figured you would slay me, and so I had to lie to you. You're getting the feeling that Abraham is not exactly the like perfect, upstanding, righteous guy that we might want to stick on a pedestal and say, be like Abraham. No, what he is somebody who found the grace and mercy of God. And so he said, I thought you would slay me for my wife's sake. Verse 12, and yet indeed she is my sister. I've got you on a technicality. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. So he married his half-sister. Not uncommon, again, in the early portions of Genesis. Nothing wrong with that. But he's saying, hey, we share a dad. That makes her my half-sister. So I wasn't lying when I said she was my sister. Excuse, excuse, excuse. Cover up, backstroke, backstroke. And it came to pass, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said unto her, this is thy kindness which thou shalt show unto me. At every place where we shall come, say of me, he is my brother. So this is an agreement the two of them had, that when they traveled and went into foreign cities, they would say they were brother and sister rather than husband and wife, in hopes that nobody would kill Abraham. Pretty sheepish, by the way, of Abraham here. Not exactly walking around with that confidence of, you know, I have actually spoken to God. Not only have I spoken of God, he's promised me this land and an heir. Oh yeah, did I tell you about the time that I ever talked him down from 50 to 5? I mean, I have this relationship with God, and yet has an agreement with his wife to preserve his own life, that they would go in and lie to people. Where's this confidence? Where's that boldness he should be walking on? Prophet of God, Abraham, I'm going to own all this land. None of that. It's like, don't kill me, okay? Because my wife's pretty, so here, take her. So then, verse 14. And Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants. Now, how rich was Abraham to start with? Remember, he had the standing army and he had so much that he and Lot couldn't dwell in the same plain together. Such wealth, he was able to go and fight the five kings and win and come back. And Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants and gave them all to Abraham and restored him Sarah, his wife. So Abimelech went way above, way beyond, and said, here's your wife, and oh yeah, let me give you a lot of stuff, because whoever that God is, he's on your side. And I want favor with that God, because he said he was going to kill me. So let me give you a lot of stuff, trying to curry favor with Abraham.
And could you pray for me?
And by the way, could you pray for me? Could you make it a good prayer? And Abimelech said, behold, my land is before thee. Dwell wherever it pleases you. Just take a place. Whatever's good for you, that's good with me. Just don't kill me. And unto Sarah he said, behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver on top of everything else. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all other. Thus she was corrected or reproved. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bore children, for the Lord had closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Isn't that amazing? So just because he took Abraham's wife, God made sure there were no offspring at all anywhere in his house. Why? Because this whole offspring of Sarah thing is so important that no wombs were going to be opened and no children were going to be produced as long as Sarah was not with Abraham. So there's like no confusion about who the offspring is. God takes this whole Abrahamic covenant thing very seriously. So then chapter 21 starts, and the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. Remember, a couple weeks ago we saw that the angels said to her, while she was behind him in a tent, and said to Abram, next year at this set time, she will bear a child. And now Moses confirms it. Yes, indeed, at that exact set time, that's when he had the babies. Now, this phrase, set times, is a very important phrase because when God deals with Moses at Mount Sinai, he's going to lay out what are called the feasts of the Lord. The Old English translation is feasts. Feasts of the Lord, but it's actually the Hebrew word that is set times. The set times of God. That God set three times a year, particular days aside, where every Jew that could travel had to appear before the Lord. Three times a year in set times. In other words, we're seeing another consistent characteristic of God, which is that God created time, he's in control of time, and he is a God of set times. God sets the times, he sets the boundaries of time, and it is God who determined the day you were born and how many breaths you'll take and the day you'll die, and all the events of your life are on God's great eternal calendar because he is a God of set times. And that phrase turns up a lot in Moses' writing, that God has set times. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had proposed or had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, who Sarah bore to him, Isaac, which means laughter. Why did they name him that? Because she laughed when God told her. And then God said, well, then name him laughter. You're always going to remember that you laughed. Now, though, before she kind of laughed, I think, in disbelief. Now she names him laughter and she turns around and says, I'm laughing because I'm happy. And everybody who hears that I've borne a son in my late age is going to laugh with me. So it turns that name into a good thing. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him. This would then have been the first child circumcised according to the way God said to do it. You will remember that he did circumcise all the servants in his house, and he did circumcise Ishmael, but Ishmael was already a teenager. But God said, on the 8th day, you'll circumcise your seed and all the generations after you. Isaac was the first one to actually be circumcised, completely in keeping with the dictates God had laid out. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. Boy, he waited a long time, didn't he? And God promised him this how many years ago? 25? He was 75 when he first heard the promise. Walking around for 25 years going, no, really, God promised me. He promised me a son, which in Middle Eastern culture, what a big deal. An heir, an offspring, a natural offspring for me and my wife, and he's going to inherit everything I have. And all the promises God has given me are all going to go to my son. 25 years he walked around not getting the promise. But did that change the promise? No. See, one of the things that people struggle with where God's concerned, Peter certainly writes about it in his epistles, that there will be scoffers in the end days who will say, well then, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the Father slept, all things have remained the same. Life goes on. You've got Christians running around saying, no, he's coming back. But Peter says there will be scoffers who will say, no, he's not. Because look how long it's been since he left. And then Peter, of course, says, but God is not slack concerning his promise. You have to remember that a day with the Lord is 1,000 years and 1,000 years like a day. So if you think by that reckoning, we think, well, it's been 2,000 years since he left the planet. When's he coming back? In God's reckoning, that was Tuesday. He'll be back Thursday. So the idea here is God always, always keeps his promises. But he keeps them according to his set times. And we have to be willing to let God set those times and keep those promises. And there has been so much theology developed over the course of the last, especially 2,000 years, because God simply has not yet kept certain biblical promises. We've talked about it a lot here in this church, that there are a bunch of promises in the Old Testament made to particular people that God just hasn't kept. And so people have tried to protect God's reputation and tried to explain that he has kept those promises, but that he kept them in some other way. And that's exactly the kind of thinking Abraham had. Well, I'll just go in the tent with Hagar and produce an offspring. There, the promise was kept, but it was kept in some other way. I don't have a problem in the world believing that God could wait around 2,000 years to keep promises that he made to particular people. He has a long history of making people wait a long time to see their promises. Yes, sir?
And also in the passage you're quoting from Peter, he is gracious by the Holy Spirit to give us some more insight there when he says that God is not slack, as some might consider. And he also mentions the promise and the patience and the working of God to usward.
Right, long-suffering toward usward.
Not willing that any,
yeah.
And the implied there is of usward, any of us
perish
who were part of his plan should perish.
Right.
And so, you know, that's a reminder to us that if we get impatient or if people around us doubt and scoff, God's got higher purposes and higher goals to accomplish that go way beyond us,
right?
Including the salvation of those that he's not willing to perish.
Absolutely. And look, we as Christians have no problem saying Christ left the planet, let's say, somewhere between 30 and 33 AD. And here we are in 2007 AD, so it's coming up on, we're just shy of 2,000 years since he left. But are we still confident he's coming back? Yeah, that's one of the primary Christian hopes and goals. Paul calls it the blessed hope and writes that to those who are looking for him and return again in glory, all these great promises of the return of Christ. And the 2,000-year interim isn't a problem for us. We still say, well, yes, he's coming back. And that is exactly and precisely the attitude I take toward every promise God has made. Sure, it's been 2,000 years since he dispersed Israel. Does that mean he's not going to bring them back? No, I have all these promises saying he's going to gather them again. And people say, well, no, because it's been 2,000 years. Well, it's been 2,000 years since Jesus left. Be consistent. Pick an argument and go with it. But if you can wait 2,000 years for Jesus, then you can wait 2,000 years for the reestablishment of everything he's promised to Israel. I just don't have these kind of problems that people want to drum up in order to support other eschatologies. Yes?
Also, the Lord himself was very gracious to help us persevere by giving us the parables that talk about those who became idle or became wasteful or worthless mm-hmm. while their master was gone.
Yeah.
Just wondering or maybe doubting if he ever would come back.
Right.
And yet he does come back and takes them by surprise. And there's chastening and there's judgment that takes place.
All of that.
So, I mean, that's something that Jesus did not have to clue us in on.
Right.
But he did. Why did he do that? Because he loves us and wants to help us persevere.
Yep. Look at Abraham. During that 25-year period, you see all the ups and downs. You see all the victories, you see all the defeats. You see him just being human, waiting on God to finally do what God said he was going to do. And through all of that, God protected him, and he persevered. Over those 25 years, you'll notice he did not die. You'll notice Sarah did not die. You'll notice that God kept them until he had fulfilled every promise he'd ever made to them. Because that's the faithfulness of God who makes promises to his people and then keeps them every whit. And that should give us a great deal of confidence. So let me just wrap up here tonight, and I'll let you go, because this next section I could go for on an hour, so I'm just going to wait and pick it up next week. So Abraham, verse 4, circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. And Sarah said, God has made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should have given children suck? For I have borne him a son in his old age. So she turned that laughter thing into a very positive thing. Said, who would have believed this? And everybody who hears it's going to laugh with me. This is a very good thing. So now, picking up at verse 8, we're going to see the tension that grows between Ishmael and Isaac, and the casting out of the bondwoman, which is theology Paul picks up in Galatians. And then we've got to talk about children of bondage and children of the free, which takes us into law versus grace, and I can use up an hour easily on all that. So the wisest thing to do is I'll let you go home tonight. We'll all come back here next week and dig into all this stuff. Okay? All right, good.
thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.